Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and once again, it is my pleasure and my honor and privilege to be joined by Colonel Dan Marvin, U.S. Army Special Forces retired, an individual who has been involved in some very important aspects of American history, although aspects of American history that have been sadly covered up to date. Colonel Marvin, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you. Proud and pleasured to be with you, Dave.
Now, we were talking about the apparent attempt to recruit you, it wasn't an apparent attempt, the attempt to recruit you to kill Commander Bruce Pitzer, apparently as a result of his involvement with President Kennedy's autopsy in Bethesda Naval Hospital, the fact that he had filmed it, had information that was damning to the official version, and that this appears to have been the real reason for his termination, officially listed as a suicide. President Kennedy's assassination paved the way for a much wider U.S. involvement in Vietnam than would otherwise have taken place. And what I'd like to turn to next is your stint of duty, your tour of duty in Vietnam. Now, you were with the Special Forces.
Yes.
And you were involved with what is known as an A-team in Vietnam. Now, could you tell us briefly, Dan, what is a Special Forces A-team? What do they do?
Well, an A-team is the operational unit of Special Forces. That is a unit, a small unit, somewhere between, supposed to have from 12 to 18 people, depending on your mission. Mine had from 7 to 11 at the highest. It goes into an area and organizes and guides and advises, and in certain cases, like in my case, directs the operations of a large mercenary or civilian irregular indigenous kind of operation. In my own case, I was asked to accept it on an independent operation basis, where once I left the headquarters of the C detachment at Can Tho and went to An Phu to where my camp was, there was nobody telling me what to do. Otherwise, my mission was to guard 30 kilometers of border with Cambodia and to be the first Americans to actually bombard Cambodia with our indirect weapons, and to be able to go across the border into Cambodia on the ground against the enemy. We were the very first one, and that first action was actually on the 1st of January, 1966. I went in on the 27th day of December, 1965. My counterpart was one of the finest men I ever met in my life, Major Lee Van Foy. And I worked with the Wahaos, and Wahaos are a militant sect of the Buddhist religion, and an absolutely wonderful bunch of people. There are 64,000 Wahaos in my area. Am I going too far?
No. Dave? This is fine, Dave. I just wanted to stop again for the benefit of people who are taking notes, and to spell Wahao. That's spelled
Wahao is H-O-A. Hyphen H-A-O, Wahao, is the way it's pronounced.
And they, again, were?
They were a militant sect of the Buddhist religion. They were in Chau Duc and Anjai provinces. They actually maintained the two provinces that were on either side of the Basak River, which is spelled B-A-S-S-A-C, River, which is one of the two main rivers going into Cambodia from Vietnam. The other is the Mekong River. And by traveling, major ships can go up the Basak River and bigger ones up the Mekong River. And there was two A-team camps on that border. One was mine and the other one was at Tan Chau. And we controlled that area to include the Mekong and Basak rivers going into Cambodia.
So
those 64,000 people, just to give you a very quick idea, and more than anything, I want people to, in the United States, to know how wonderful and courageous a people they were. 64,000 people in an entire county, and there wasn't a house of ill repute. There was hardly any crime whatsoever. There was no orphanages. There was no old folks' home, because the Wahaos believed in taking care of each other. If a man got killed in an operation, his family would be automatically taken up by another member of the Wahao community. It was beautiful. It makes me cry just to think about it.
certainly is our culture dramatically different than our own, in which now, basically, if somebody experiences misfortune, that's too bad, you know, mm-hmm. and it's devil take the hindmost.
That's right. And you know what they had more than anything was courage and respect and compassion, because worldly things, 64,000 people, not one car, maybe three motorcycles or bikes, and a lot of bikes, but three motorcycles in the whole county, or, you know, the Anfu district. Figure that one out.
That, again, would contrast dramatically with American society.
Amen.
So now you and your fellow A-team members, again, whom we're going to use the nickname the BASAC Bastards, and we're
right.
going to explain the lack of official parentage in a national security sense here in a little bit. You were working with the Wahaos,
right.
a militant Buddhist sect, and your mission basically was to police, to effectively control a portion of the Vietnamese border with Cambodia. Now, bearing in mind, again, Dan, that an awful lot of people have come to life since the Vietnam War, and
mm-hmm.
much of the strategic situation of that conflict is unknown to people, could you explain why the Cambodian border was so important and outline for us the strategic situation vis-a-vis the sanctuaries that the North Vietnamese troops had there?
Well, one of the things that that was discussed with me when I was asked to volunteer to take An Phu as a command as opposed to the normal advisory role was that it would be the first authorization to go into the sanctuaries. Now, President Johnson had conspired with the Cambodian Prince Sihanouk at, I believe, and I can't prove this, but I believe at the request of the Chinese government to allow the sanctuaries to be used by the North Vietnamese across the border in Cambodia. In fact, Prince Sihanouk had turned over all those areas all along the border, and all of those areas were across from Special Forces camps. And the Viet Cong could go in there, our enemy. They could fire from there and attack from there with impunity. And I buried 200 of my people that had been killed by people coming across that border. And we could throw our own mortar fire and rifle fire and go in. But one of the problems with doing that, like I was told by the colonel that gave me the orders to go into there, was that we had no backup. We had no artillery backup when we crossed the border. We had no aircraft backup. We had no medevac. We had absolutely no backup whatsoever. And if we got caught, we were on our own. But I loved it because we were able to at least secure our area and keep our civilian casualties down and give those people there, the Wahaos, somewhat of a sense of security.
My guess is, from my studies of LBJ as a political creature, that his motive in not discussing the Cambodian sanctuaries was probably what the motives of a lot of the people who were in the commanding situations vis-a-vis our involvement in Vietnam War, and that is to basically engage in domestic damage control. If the notion of a wider war got out, it would appear that the management of this situation wasn't quite as deft as a lot of people were being told. That rather than, as some people with maybe a John Birch Society orientation might think, you know, LBJ was a crypto-communist, which certainly mm-hmm. is not the case, but rather he would simply have been trying to curry domestic political opinion a favor by indicating that everything was under control, that we were not going to have a wider war, no cause to worry. And that
it was under control, all right. Even General Westmoreland admitted that he never brought up before Congress two real vital aspects of why things were not going right. Number one was the sanctuaries, and it wasn't the South Vietnamese President Premier Ki had nothing to do with those sanctuaries. It's strictly the United States government. He did not mention them any time he went before Congress, he being General Westmoreland, nor did he mention the fact that the new weapons that were promised the Vietnamese were never given them up to that point in time. We used, you're probably not aware of this, we used all World War II weapons in our area with our Vietnamese irregulars, paramilitary forces.
I remember seeing, you know, Garands and M1 carbines and World War II and Korea vintage weaponry in the Life magazine pictures that I used to see.
The ammunition was lousy. It was Korean vintage ammunition. I'd have as much as 25% short rounds in our 81-millimeter mortar ammunition.
Mm, not something that you would want to have.
That's right.
Now, again, we have a situation in which Prince Sihanouk is basically sanctioning the Vietnamese, perhaps recognizing their obviously superior military power or whatever, was permitting the North Vietnamese to use portions of Cambodia as a strategic military sanctuary. This got him into hot water with the United States, did it not?
Well, I don't know. I believe that it was a coordinated effort between our government and the Chinese government and Prince Sihanouk to allow those sanctuaries. Now, when Prince Sihanouk went against us as far as our relationship with him, I think that was on his own, that is when it was decided that he should go.
Well, in other words, what I'm saying is he broke diplomatic relations with the United States. In other words, this is what I'm driving at, is that that ultimately the conflict between the U.S. military orientation there, even though LBJ was not publicly discussing the Cambodian sanctuaries, the difference of opinion between the U.S. Command, including LBJ, and Nordam Sihanouk led to a formal diplomatic break. A severing of diplomatic relations between the United States and Cambodia.
That is correct.
Now, at this time, and bearing in mind the strategic situation that we've already outlined, with Cambodia being used as a strategic sanctuary, with yourself and the Wahaos and your fellow A-team members basically being in charge with enforcing the security of this particular portion of the border, you were then once again tabbed by someone from the CIA.
Yes, the Aramaca chopper flew in with one of their agents and his girlfriend and met with myself and Major Foy in the command bunker and had some top secret plans with him and asked me if I would organize a Wahao force to go 100 miles into Cambodia and to ambush and kill Cambodian Crown Prince Sihanouk, and this was on the 12th day of June in 1966. And he said that the whole idea of the operation was to make it look like the North Vietnamese had done it so that then Prince Sihanouk would be, his loyal forces would then go up against the Viet Cong, the arm of the North Vietnamese government that was trying, you know, that was using those sanctuaries. Mm-hmm. It sounded like a real good thing to me at the time, and I said, sure, I'll accept it. And I said, I want this. I want President Johnson, before we actually go across that border, I want President Johnson to tell the American people, tell them publicly, have it in the New York Times, that he had authorized those sanctuaries in the past and that he was denying them now and has given all of our forces orders to go across that border anytime it was necessary in hot pursuit. Okay, so I went about then with my men, with my A-team, and a lot of them are still here alive and in the United States, training these people, 42 of them, for this mission. They're all volunteers, so, you know, all knew it was a suicide mission to go into Cambodia. And just about 2 days before it was to happen, the CIA agent came back to the camp, and he didn't even want to discuss what I'd asked him to do as far as President Johnson goes, so I canceled I just unilaterally stopped the operation right then on Sihanouk. And I sent the CIA agent packing out of my camp on the chopper. And he wasn't very happy. The last thing he said when he left the camp was, you can't fight the company captain because you can't win. And within 3 days, I knew what he was talking about, because within 3 days, I learned through my own agents that an entire regiment of the Arvin division that's located in the 4th Corps was being sent to attack my camp with instructions specifically given to the American advisors, which a Colonel William Desabree can affirm, because he was in the chopper, which I'll get to later with General Dang. But they were ordered to attack Aunt Fu because there was a renegade captain named Marvin, that they called me, a renegade captain who was leading the Wahaos against the Saigon government.
Now, again, you accepted the mission to train a group of Wahaos and to go in, assassinate Crown Prince Norton Sihanouk, the head of state of Cambodia, and to set it up in such a way as the North Vietnamese would get the blame.
Yes.
This then would precipitate hostilities, presumably, between the loyal Cambodian troops and the North Vietnamese and deny them their sanctuary inside of Cambodia.
Yes.
We should also note, by the way, in passing, for listeners that would like to follow up on some of this information, that Prince Sihanouk himself published a book many years later called My War with the CIA. I don't know if it's still in print or not. Listeners can check the used bookstores. So that in terms of Prince Sihanouk's own jousting with the Central Intelligence Agency, there is a record of that. Again, it's called My War with the CIA. Now, again, Dan, you refused to carry out this assignment because there was going to be no official recognition of the existence of the sanctuaries, and this would have greatly limited the air, military, and medical support that your unit's operations would have gotten in that area.
That's right. Well, I figured this, that the nullification of the sanctuaries by what action we were taking couldn't take place as long as President Johnson wanted them to exist. That's why I insisted as a quid pro quo, I guess, of the operation of us going into there, or my sending my men into there, that he would have to cease the sanctuaries as far as U.S. complicity.
And so then when you refused this assignment, first of all, you were given orders over a period of several days to withdraw your entire A-team from that area, orders which you refused. Could you tell us why?
Well, I really figured that the orders, which came down through channels to the B-team and then to me, was to get us out on the Basak River and headed into the B-team and then to ambush us. And at the same time, we would then leave the Vietnamese, the Wahaos, without anybody to represent them from the United States military.
So in other words, you felt that by being ordered to withdraw along the Basak River that you were basically being set up.
Yes.
This was your Dealey Plaza motorcade, so to speak.
That's correct.
Now,
no different than what they might have asked me to do. No different than the movie Apocalypse Now, which is based on fact.
And in fact, you were being represented as sort of like that, was it Colonel Kurtz, who the character played by Marlon Brando?
Yes.
In other words, you were, other American advisors were being told that you were a, quote, renegade Green Beret, unquote.
Yes. And the big difference between myself and Colonel Kurt was that my men, God bless them, brave men, all decided to stay with me when I was ordered out. I gave them their own, their own direction on it, whichever way they want to do it, and they all decided to stay and protect the Wahaos.
And, again, we should note that the word was basically going out, though, that you and your fellow A-team members were renegade Green Beret who were going to lead the Wahaos against the South Vietnamese government.
That's right.
Then, an elite Arvin regiment, and by the way, Arvin stands for?
Army of Republic of Vietnam.
Again, the former South Vietnam.
Right.
Was basically being recruited, or they were being ordered and positioned to wipe out not only you and your men, but also the Wahaos.
Right.
Can you tell us a couple of things, Dan? First of all, what happened? Obviously, you were not wiped out. You're still here. Tell us about the contingency.
Well, I'll tell you, we did a lot of things. We sweat a lot. We prayed a lot. We wired the entire camp with demolitions so that if the regiment, when they made it to the main gate of the camp, we did not want to be prisoners. We wanted to, you could call it make a statement, but we just wanted to not be taken in and tortured or anything else. So we decided, Major Foy and my men and myself, that we would just blow up the entire camp when they came in the main gate. And then thirdly, Major Foy sent an emissary down the Basak River, a civilian emissary, a member of the Wahao religion, to find General Dang, because we just knew that General Kong Van Dang, or Dang Van Quan, either way you want to put it, The commanding general, 4th Corps, was not aware of this, was not involved in it. I had met him. He's just a wonderful general. He's just one of the most wonderful people I'd ever met. And he'd been to my camp in a victory celebration. And we just knew, especially Major Foy, that General Dang didn't know of our circumstance. And if he knew of it, he'd do something. And he did. When the emissary got to Dang, Dang picked up the phone and called Premier Key. Told him, basically, I am taking over the situation because I am concerned about brother killing brother. And he hung up the phone. He got a hold of Colonel William Desabree, who was our senior advisor to General Dang in the 4th Corps, the Commanding General's office. Got into Colonel Desabree's helicopter, flew up the Baysack River, got right on top of the regiment as they were within 2 minutes of hitting our camp. And Colonel Desabree, for General Dang, because he was using American communications, told the American advisors to tell the colonel commanding that regiment to stop and return home. And that's how General Dang saved our buns.
If I could just prevail on you, Dan, to spell out some of the names. First of all, Colonel, it begins with a D?
Yeah, William Desabree, D-E-S-O-B-R-E. R-Y.
Again, about the people who may be taking notes in the audience. And General Dang?
Okay, it's Q-U-A-N-G hyphen Van hyphen Dang. When we were there, it was the opposite. It was Dang Van Quang.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll read. I read 120 books that had all kinds of disinformation about General Quang, is what he's shown as in the books, the 4th Corps Commanding General. And it's all a pack of lies that went out under the Operation Mockingbird, which you're probably aware of, that the CIA instituted within 2 weeks after he came to our rescue.
That is a disinformation campaign.
That is correct.
And this is in no way to cast aspersions on what you're saying, Dan. I am not familiar with the gentleman at all, so I personally can't speak yea or nay with regard to his character. I've seen some of the articles you sent me, and they certainly were doing a number on him.
I quoted all those articles.
Right.
I quoted the books, and I sent it all through my congressman to the State Department and fought. And finally, I think, my letter to President Bush, which basically I wrote and told President Bush that I was intimately familiar with some of his associations with the Central Intelligence Agency and prior to his becoming the head of it, and that I wanted a complete investigation and clearing of General Dang, and that I would fight on until he was in this country, into the United States from Canada, or which is where he had been sent in kind of quasi-exile, or until Jesus Christ returned, whichever one came first.
Okay. Dan, I want to ask you a subjective question.
Yes.
How common, the events that you've just related will seem shocking to many members of the audience. In other words, here basically was an American-allied unit being requisitioned to annihilate American-allied troops and American advisors. To people familiar with some of the sordid history, not only of American national security operations, again, those aspects of it that are sordid, and also with the world of covert operations, it would not seem so shocking. In your opinion, how common was this sort of skullduggery and seeming double cross, or even perhaps perversion would be a better word, a total perversion of what one would expect? How common was this kind of thing behind the scenes in Vietnam?
Well, I'd say it wasn't too common because there's not too many people who would go against the system.
Right.
Now, for example, there was a captain who commanded a team in a camp called Vinja, which is V-I-N-G-H-I-A, right on the Cambodian border canal with Vietnam, south of my camp. And a regiment was stationed, a Viet Cong, an enemy regiment was in a hill across that canal, and they fired into his camp, killed 6 of his people. He fired back at them against the rules. You know, that was their sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not like me. He was not under independent operation status. Mine was the first one in 27th of December, 1965. He was taken out of that camp and sent back to Fort Leavenworth, and that's where he ended up.
And that, of course, is
for disobeying orders, mm-hmm. for protecting our men, for protecting our allies for firing against the orders he ended up in Fort Leavenworth.
Okay, we're getting near the end of the interview here, Dan. A couple of questions. Now, the type of research that I do and the sort of account that you've been presenting, both of your experiences with the intelligence officer who was trying to recruit you to kill Commander Pitzer, mm-hmm. and also with regard to the experiences of your fellow A-team members, again, the BASAC bastards, you've
right.
nicknamed them, bastards in this sense, because in a national security sense, they were orphaned. They were
Amen.
They were cut loose by their real national security
That's
parents.
Right.
This type of research and the type of account you've been giving is going to be demeaned by those critics. Norman Mailer, the author and novelist, he had an interesting statement that I think is true. He said, in the age of intelligence, meaning espionage, not intellect, but in the age of intelligence, every truth is obliged to live in the presence of its denial.
Mm.
To those people who would demean what you've been saying as conspiracy theory or whatever, how would you respond to that?
I would respond to that by telling them to take pen in hand, mm-hmm. or a typewriter, a computer, or whatever they use to write, and write a letter to their congressman and ask him to investigate the allegations of Colonel Dan Marvin and send me a copy of that letter and ask me any questions they want to 715 Hector Street, and that's spelled H-E-C-T-O-R, Hector Street, Ithaca, and that's spelled I-T-H-A-C-A, Ithaca, New York, 14850.
One more time, Dan, slowly, because there may be people taking some notes out there. Nice and slow.
That's 715 Hector Street.
H-E-C-T-O-R.
Right. Ithaca, that's I-T-H-A-C-A, New York, 14850. But don't bother to write if you're not going to send a signed copy of a letter that you wrote to your congressman or senator asking that it be investigated, because I will not respond.
Okay. Now, something that I wanted to mention, Dan, is that your story, I think, is buttressed to a considerable extent in terms of journalistic or historical credibility by a recent book about the assassination of Martin Luther King called Orders to Kill,
yes.
by William F. Pepper. This yes. is a book well known to members of my audience. In fact, it was just about exactly a year ago that I was reading sections of it. This book describes, and it's a remarkable account by a very courageous writer who is now James Earl Ray's attorney. He was the patsy
Amen.
For Martin Luther King's assassination, and it describes how an organized crime figure was recruited to actually pull the trigger on Martin Luther mm-hmm. King, but that as a backup, a Special Forces A-team from the 20th Special Forces Group assigned to, I believe it was the 902nd Military Intelligence Group,
mm-hmm.
was in Memphis, Tennessee, and positioned to kill Martin Luther King and also Andrew Young, later President Carter's ambassador to the UN, in the event that the organized crime sniper missed.
I think it's remarkable that nothing has happened in Congress when General Westmoreland himself, not General Westmoreland, excuse me, General Yarbrough, William P. Yarbrough, and that's spelled Y-A-R-B-O-R-O-U-G-H. He's retired and lives in Southern Pines, North Carolina, outside of Fort Bragg, right today. When he states unequivocally in there that Special Forces were assigned the duty of providing intelligence on the movement of Martin Luther King and his right-hand man, had orders to kill if necessary.
And
Special Forces, Green Berets, Army people
mm-hmm.
used today. I mean, well, probably still today if that was the case then, too.
The point being that there's a remarkable degree of documentation. The author, William Pepper, has the names of the people in the unit. They provided him with copies of the orders. They, by the way, also, many of them are out of the surviving members are out of the country and in fear of their lives.
Yeah, they didn't give the right names either. And two of them, by the way, claim to have been in the only unit that was crossed the border into Cambodia in early 1966, so that means those two men were assigned to my camp. But the names are not the right names when they say that.
Well, yeah, William Pepper indicates that living members of the team are presented under pseudonyms.
That's
only
right.
The deceased members have their real names used. Dan, we're almost out of time
okay.
here. One thing I was wondering, do you think that the other members of your team would object to my reading their names on the air and thanking them for their sacrifice?
Of my team.
Yeah, meaning your A-team, because I have...
Oh, absolutely. I think that'd be wonderful.
Okay, the Baysac Bastards, again, the A-team that was assigned to the Wahows and that was engaged in this unit. Spec 4 Woolley, Sergeant Gore, Sergeant First Class Johnson, Spec 5 Sirois, S-I-R-O-I-S, Sergeant First Class Taylor, of course, then Captain, later Colonel Dan Marvin, Master Sergeant Fox, and Second Lieutenant Strait. And if you could extend to the surviving members of your team... my thanks and the thanks of the American people. And this is said, by the way, as someone that was opposed to the war, although also very critical of the anti-war movement. But I want to thank you and your men for your sacrifice, and I also want to thank you personally, Colonel Marvin, for coming forward and relating your story to us.
Thank you very kindly. God bless you. Keep up the good work.
I will do that.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, this is Dave Emery for Colonel Dan Marvin. Thanks for listening.